managers, minor league managers, and so on and so forth.
So you, any particular memorable game or series in all the many years that you've seen them that, or that particular series that stands out?
That particular series, it's the one play overshadowed anything when Vic Wirtz hit that ball and May scored it.
You think that kind of one, just that one play, changes the whole temperature and the whole chemistry of the series?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you think it takes the heart? We're talking about professionals.
There's no ballpark today where the ball Wirtz hit would still be in the ballpark. It just happened in a straightaway center field in the Polo Grounds, which was a long way.
Yeah, a lot of acres out there.
A lot of acreage. And that rascal, he just outran the ball and caught it running full tilt away. Yeah. I mean, there wasn't any jogging involved. This was a full tilt run, and he just happened to see the ball and bing, caught it. And the amazing thing was he made the turn and got the ball back in.
He might have thought at that moment, he said, "Look, Mama, I got it."
But the thing that killed Cleveland in that series was Al Rosen couldn't play. I mean,
he was their outstanding rookie,
and he just couldn't play. He was hurt. He was in the lineup but couldn't play.
Mm-hmm. Jack, going back to the American Association, AAA, some outstanding managers, many of whom you have mentioned. Could you give us a kind of a, here you are managing the Toledo Mud Hens, kind of a itinerary of saying, okay, on a road trip and off to the Twin Cities, St. Paul Saints, Minneapolis Millers. Can you visualize in your mind as, taking the train trip, going to the ballpark, some of the things that you did that were peculiar to baseball? Did you leave the ball? Well, let's say you got on the train.
Train.
From Toledo and off to the Twin Cities. The players, what, did you have a curfew for them, or they just went to bed and you kind of left them alone?
You got on that train and you went to Chicago, of course. Switched trains.
Mm-hmm.
All the trains went to Chicago. And switched trains. And we had the Pullman cars. One car, uppers and lowers, and a tough time managing, deciding who's going to be in the uppers and who's going to be in the lowers,
Oh, there was status in that, too.
Oh, there was status in that. And never had any problems, really.
Mm-hmm.
And
so the veterans took the lower berths and the rookies took the upper?
The everyday players were assured of a lower berth.
Uh-huh.
And the guy who was going to pitch the next day. And if there was any left over, the guy that pitched the previous game, he got a lower berth.
So you assigned the berths?
Well, if there were any lowers left, you threw some numbers in a hat and you picked them out.
Okay, kind of a little lottery.
Try to be as democratic as you could.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to think while I'm talking here what the player limit was in those days. I think it was about 21 or 22 at AAA.
Mm-hmm.
Which wasn't too bad. Now, today their player limits are much higher because they're carrying rehabilitated major leaguers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And their player limits are much higher.
Yeah. So then catch another train off to the Twin Cities.
You had these cars, and they had great rapport with the railroad people in those days, AAA and Major Leagues. And your traveling secretary, I know the Detroit traveling secretary in those days, Claire Berry, is a former Major League, former railroad man before he came to the Major Leagues, and he knew who to see. And you would get that car, and sometimes, like when we went to Louisville, from Toledo, we'd get down there in a car and go play a two or three game series, whatever it was, and come back and our car stayed right there.
Right there at the station.
We didn't live in the car while we were there,
uh-huh.
But I mean, we'd come out of the hotel,
and get right in our car and wait till they hooked it up and away we
off,
go.
Off you went.
It was a marvelous arrangement. But today, everything is bus drive. I think the AAAs will have to travel by plane today because...
Well, you got the Pacific Coast League, you got Colorado Springs and Vancouver and Calgary. I mean, you're not going to do that by train. Play five games and travel 10. You get out to Minneapolis.
Oh, my gracious.
Yeah, there's some loneliness there. You get ready for infield practice. What'd you look for in the players? See if they were really going to, in batting practice, to see if they were on cue. Say you're some of your heavy hitters and they were taking batting practice. You would be there behind the cage looking. What would you look for?
The talent was evident. You know, the talent was evident. You didn't have to look for talent. You
no. Knew talent. But you want to see how they, if they were in the group.
You wanted to see their worth ethic.
That's right.
Particular day.
Or how they were hitting and batting practice before the game. How the infielders were taking.
In higher baseball, no. In lower baseball, yes. In higher baseball, you didn't concern yourself too much because you had older guys and they. If you had a young 19-year-old prospect, mm-hmm. yes. But if you had a guy like in Toledo, I had Bill Barnacle, mm-hmm. I had Alex De La Garza, mm-hmm. Paul Campbell, mm-hmm. Don Lund, Red McQuillan, mm-hmm. guys like that. You knew what they could do and what...
Most of them been in the big leagues anyway.
Yeah, and you knew what they were capable of doing, and they... just go through the motions sometimes of batting practice or fielding practice. But you made them do it mm-hmm. just to keep the young guys alive that there's things that you have to do. Mm-hmm. And you did a lot of family work. You knew about the guy's family and whether he was having a problem mm-hmm. or not, and you could help him.
So you might be a father counselor?
Sort of. But you don't have that today. Because today... especially in your AAA, the ball players are making a lot more money than the manager.
Same way in the majors.
Well, if a guy's on a major league roster and they send him down to AAA club, he's getting a pretty good salary.
Yeah.
And your job is magnified. You don't. Your job is trying to keep them alert to baseball, and you don't have time to get into their family problems and help them out. And it's changed. I couldn't manage today.
Couldn't do it at all?
I couldn't do it today. I had a long talk with Sparky just not too long ago.
Well, now he's made that transition, and incredibly so.
Incredibly so is right. But one of the reasons they're making that transition, those kind of guys, is the manager's salary has gone up. Like the Herzogs, when he was managing, mm-hmm. his salary was $500,000 a year, which isn't too much if you're comparing it to the player's salary, but they've made it.
Well, their salary may have gone up, but you know, you're talking to a lot of ball players that hit 260 and making $1 million.
Yeah.
So it's not just a matter of the manager's salary is going up to make the transition.
Well, what I meant by that,
how do you work with this?
What I meant by that was their salary is good enough now where they can take these pitfalls and different things they're trapped into by being a major league manager.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does Sparky make the transition? Let's take him now. He's one of the few. Herzog is another that
Whitey couldn't take it. He had to get out.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I think he's going to come back. I saw his name in the paper this morning about...
he'd like to come back with an expansion team because a manager's role with an expansion club would be a lot different than his was with the Cardinals or Sparky's is with the Tigers. But Sparky is one in a million.
He's the exception.
He is the exception to the rule. You can tell that by the turnovers. They just can't get the job done with these modern-day ball players.
Well, what kind of attitudes has he developed to make that transition? You're right. He's one in a million. He's probably the only one left that knew the reserve clause and the days when salaries were a lot lower.
I don't know if I can explain it to you what how he made that transition, but he made it. But he's got older players, and he plays everybody every day. You know, the Deers and the Incaviglias mm-hmm. and whatever you got there. And how he does it, Dan, I don't know.
But because he has good PR skills, public relations skills. He knows how to handle the press.
You made that remark earlier, PR skills, the manager mm-hmm. so necessary today. Sparky's the best.
He's the best.
One of the best. And by that I mean a good PR man doesn't talk just to talk. Mm-hmm. Anytime Sparky talks, the guy knows he's going to get something that's worthwhile using, not some fly-by-night remark mm-hmm. about a different talent. Or, mm-hmm. And Sparky's a master.
Yes, he is.
I don't know who in the big leagues can compare to him today. Lasorda.
Yes.
But you go anybody else. Craig is a good manager, but he's not a PR man.
That's right. He's quiet, reserved.
Would rather be away. Mm-hmm. Sparky holds fort every day, and reading the newspapers and watching sports shows, you know Lasorda does too, mm-hmm. yeah. with the newspaper mm-hmm. man. He's honest with them, and fortunately...
How do you be honest with the sports writers who ask personal questions about ball players and also keep the loyalty and confidentiality of the ball players?
Well, I heard Sparky one time with a fellow that was asking a question about the personal life of a ball player, and Sparky just said to him, "I don't get into that." Mm-hmm. That was it.
Questions that 40 years ago would not have been asked.
No. Well, you had an altogether different writer 40 years yeah. ago.
You find a lot of the writers and TV sports casters pretty ignorant of the game? Or do they? Have you found
them? Not a lot of them, but quite a few who have supposed to be responsible positions are. Mm-hmm. But in those days, like when I was in Detroit, there was Al Middlesworth, Edgar Hayes, Sam Green, and Leo McDonald. Mm-hmm. Older guys that weren't in competition with one another, mm-hmm. trying to scoop one another, mm-hmm. and writing things that you know weren't true. Today they write all kind of garbage
yeah.
that isn't true. Like Canseco coming out of Madonna's apartment in New York at 2 o'clock in the not her apartment, her apartment building. He might have been visiting somebody else that yeah. lived in that apartment.
And that whenever that happened, a month, 2 months ago, and they're still harping on it.
And the player years ago could come to the manager and say, "Hey, this is bad." So the manager could go to the sport writer and tell him, "This is bad." Mm-hmm. You couldn't do that today.
No.
Well, they fight. They have fist fights with writers today.
Yeah. As a manager, how did you keep morale high, let's say, with players that didn't get to play every day? Many of them rode the bench for maybe a week or so at a time. Others out there in the bullpen. You know, we didn't have the specialist relievers that we had today. How do you juggle that so that all those players had a chance to get in the game, even when the game was going well and you really didn't need to bring them in?
I don't know if you can explain it other than to say you had to be fair. And you had to gain the confidence and respect of those players and point out to them, "Now, you're not playing today mm-hmm. because this guy is a better ball player than you are." You had to find a way to get that across to them
without
being
saying
that blunt.
Without being that blunt.
Yeah. I remember one time I had J.W. Porter. You remember it? Big bonus player with the White Sox, and he eventually wound up in Detroit. And I had Earl Torgerson, was playing first base for me. the best judges of talent in baseball are ball players' wives, and bartenders. They know talent better than anybody, especially the ball player or his wife. And we're in a real tight ball game in Detroit. We got the tying run on second, winning run on first. Torgerson's the hitter, and we were facing the White Sox, and Billy Pierce was the pitcher. And Billy Pierce could eat Torgerson up. So here's a guy with, at that time, about 12 years in the big leagues, on a pedestal of his own making. And I call him back to the dugout, and I put J.W. Porter in to hit for him, which is like taking Archbishop Fulton Sheen out and putting a parish priest in to speak for him, you know. And Torgerson's burning, but I can't help it. I got to try to win the game. And by making this move, I really built points with the other players. Hey, he's not afraid to take that guy out and put this. And as it turned out, Porter hits a double in the gap in right center field. Not only drove in the tying run, but he drove in the winning run. So going up the runway into the dugout after the game, Torgerson's, he's right alongside me. I don't know if he planned it that way. And he says to me, he didn't use these words, he used stronger words. He said, that was a lousy move, you know, like that. And I just turned to him and I said, what was the score? That's all I said to him.
End of conversation.
End of conversation. Now, he wanted to carry it further. He came in my room after the game. He said, I want to talk to you. I said, there's nothing to talk about. Nothing to talk about, Earl. You never hit Pierce in your life, and Pierce don't know much about Porter, and as it turned out, Porter did the job for us. That's the end of the conversation. He said, not with me it isn't. And I just said, take a hike. Just like that. And in those days, you could do that. But you can't do that today, because the agent will be in your room in 15 minutes. And I went up to the office and I told, you know, McHale was the general manager, and I told John, I said, Torgerson's gone. Now, if you want to try to trade him or what, go ahead and do it, but he's not playing anymore while I'm here. The next day he traded him to the White Sox.
Right. Now you can play with Billy Pierce.
Yeah, and he got out.
Didn't have to worry about... you mentioned... John McHale, one of the great baseball minds.
Yes. The ironic part of that story, it isn't ironic, it's it. I was his first manager in baseball in Muskegon, Michigan. My second year managing.
John later went with the Montreal, didn't he?
Yeah, he wound up the president and part owner of that.
And helped rebuild that franchise in the late 70s.
When he left Detroit, he went to Milwaukee.
When was that? In the mid-50s?
That was in 1958.
At the height of some fantastic teams in Milwaukee in those days.
That's right. He went to Milwaukee. And he was in Milwaukee. He succeeded... Bertie Tebbets succeeded him, I think. In Milwaukee. Anyway, when the club moved to Atlanta, McHale, I don't know if John went with them or not to Atlanta. I guess he did.
Yeah, he's had a remarkable career in management.
Very talented guy, very personable guy. And
what's he doing today?
He's retired.
That's what I thought.
He's living up in... in the Jupiter area, Harbor Springs or something like that.
I have to check on that. but he would give some insights into baseball from...
He'd be terrific.
You know, I'll have to check with Bill Guilfoyle, and Jupiter's not too far up the road.
He'd be terrific.
Jack, you know, we've been going on for about an hour and a half. I know you have other obligations. Are there some thoughts there? Maybe I didn't ask the right questions, or maybe you stroke a memory of a particular incident or players or associates that have meant a lot to you in the game of baseball over 50, since 1935, so that'd be 56 years. Are there any particular people that have stood out in your memory over that time that have added to the game that you know about or added to your illustrious career? You mentioned McHale, you mentioned Al Vinson.
Yeah, McHale, Vincent, of course. And Bucky Harris was great. I was a coach for Bucky 2 years in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they let him go, I succeeded as manager, which is, I would never do again.
Why?
Well, when you're a coach and they fire the manager and they put you on,
mm-hmm.
it looks like you've got the pipeline to the front office.
You did an end run on him. Is that the feeling that could have come about?
I know that feeling
uh-huh.
came about.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't so, but the feeling amongst the players, mm-hmm. not only your own ball club, other ball clubs in the league. And I would never do that again.
Mm-hmm.
If that same opportunity come up. If you went to the minor leagues and came back up, that's a different story.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't care how good you are, but the impression arises amongst the players that you undermined a little bit. And I never did, but that impression was there. Because the manager that got fired had friends amongst the players.
There's a loyalty there that...
Correct. That's right.
And coming on as manager, pretty hard to lay those perceptions to rest and do the job that is at hand.
And I felt so strongly about that I told McHale, not knowing it was going to happen, I said, if you ever fire me, don't replace me with a coach. And he did it.
Took your advice on that.
Yeah.
Because it had happened before.
And he told me later on in life, he mm-hmm. said, that was one of the reasons I did that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he didn't do too much of it himself. We had 11 owners in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they were a diverse group. Guy from Weyerhaeuser Lumber Company, I'll never forget it. His wife wanted to know why we couldn't make bats out of sawdust from the
sawmills.
And I had to point out to her that the bat has to be a solid piece. You can't make it.
Can't glue it together with sawdust.
And another one wanted us to trade so and so for Yogi Berra. Yogi was his favorite player.
Trade away the franchise for Yogi Berra.
I said, you couldn't get Yogi Berra for the whole team, including the owners.
So yeah, that comes with the territory.
Came with the territory.
Would you recommend aluminum bats for
no.
major leagues? Why?
Dangerous.
Be too lethal?
Lethal. You take a guy like Canseco or... even the other day, when Detroit played Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
and here's a guy hitting for Detroit, and really not a strong hitter,
mm-hmm.
but he hits a line drive and hurt Morris, hit him out, knocked him out of the game. And that was an aluminum bat that killed him.
Yeah.
Because the ball is about 2 inches quicker off the bat, which doesn't mean anything to the ordinary layman. But 2 inches in the flight of the ball on the initial impact is like shooting a gun.
Then it must be a pretty difficult transition for kids coming out of college to all of a sudden go to the wooden bats? Do they have to change their stance or anything like that? Or are they still keep those basic skills and just deal, hey, I got a piece of wood rather than aluminum in my hands?
A concrete example is Robin Ventura with the White Sox. He came out of Oklahoma University, the Chicago White Sox, and he broke the all-time college records, a 58 consecutive game hitting streak, batting average. He went to the White Sox, and he couldn't get a hit with a wooden bat. Now, a year and a half later, he's hitting about 320 or thereabouts. Mm-hmm. He's learned how to use the wooden bat. The metal bat is so solid, you get fooled and your bat's right there and the ball hits it and it's a base hit.
Yeah.
And you don't do that with wood.
Well, I've heard, you know, a few people write about it, hey, we're going to go to it, and I hear the major league officials saying, no way.
Well, Rob Dido, who was coach of Southern California for many years, works for the Dodgers now, and he was a highly successful college coach, one of the best. He tried to get the colleges to go back to wood.
Mm-hmm. But they're not...
The Cape Cod League this year is using wood. They outlawed metal bats. Decide a difference, Dan. Decide a difference.
Jack, thank you for these fond remembrances and insights into baseball.
Terrific.
I'll make copies. I'm sure that I didn't begin to ask all the important questions. So I'll leave the invitation open. If something sparks your mind and we can get Steve Suchok and you together, I'm always willing to come over again.
That'll take a whole day.
Okay.
Suchok was on the Tigers when I was coach there.
That's right. He was traded by the Yankees, wasn't he, in the late 40s and went over to the Tigers.
Yeah, and when I was a coach there in 56, Steve was on the ball club.
He was a good hitter.
Steve, as I say, was playing in the day, I mentioned earlier, where ball players were a dime a dozen.
Mm-hmm.
And today, the ball players are so scarce, there's guys playing in the big leagues every day that couldn't be on a major league club in Suchok's mm-hmm. day. And Suchok was a part-time player.
Well, he did right well in the minor leagues and then came up, and of course, Yankees had that dynasty going again, and he couldn't break into the lineup.
Outstanding.
I was telling him when I interviewed him for the Hall of Fame about that perfect game that Carl DeRose pitched in 1947 with the Blues. Well, Steve played first base. That was against the Minneapolis Millers. Remember old Babe Barna?
Oh, yes, sir.
And Babe Barna was the last batter up in the top of the ninth, 3-2 count. And a fellow by the name of Austin was the umpire. He had a fiery temper.
I knew him.
Did you?
Yes, indeed.
And same last name as mine. And ball came in probably just below the chin on a 3-2 count, but it was a strike. Babe Barna, the man he wasn't going to argue with that. He says, hey, that's his day. DeRose had a sore arm. Billy Meyer was the manager of the Kansas City Blues, later went with the Pittsburgh Pirates. And that was the last game he ever pitched. Packed up his bags and went home.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. Babe Barna lived in Charleston, West Virginia.
He was a big man.
Oh.
Boy, he could tear the fences down in Minneapolis.
You don't see that type guy anymore.
No. I remember Milwaukee Brewers had a fellow by the name of Heinz Becker.
I know him.
He was that same kind of build and huskiness and aggressiveness.
Went to the Cubs later on.
Yeah. But never heard much about him when he went to the Cubs. And he tore the fences down in the association.
Triple-A baseball in those days was terrific.
Yeah,
it was probably more entertaining than the big leagues.
Yeah. Jack, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Glad that we had a chance to meet after at least 30 phone calls in the past few months. And so I really appreciate your taking the time to share these thoughts and memories about baseball for the Hall of Fame.
I would like to sit down with you and Suchak and do it.
Okay.
Tape something.
Okay. We'll both call him and say, let's do it.
Good.
Thank you very much.